Annie Rourke Rubenstein sat at the farthest interior edge of the platform, her feet swinging in the air over the side. When she swung them back, she could not see them under the hem of her flared skirt. When she swung them forward, she watched them intensely. What was she doing here? Her husband, her father, her brother, and her many friends, solely because they were men, were outside of this granite cocoon, preparing to fight, or fighting already, perhaps dying already. But because she was female, she was here, in as much safety as the men could provide. Women were physically smaller, of course, or usually so, at least. And all things being equal, they were possessed of less upper body strength. Generally, men could run faster. She never wished to be a man, was always quite content with her womanhood, more so since marrying Paul. But she was never content with the idea that a person should be excluded from any activity simply due to gender. She pulled her feet up and turned around, bringing her knees almost to her chin. There were no men here, not a single one. The other women in the bunker included wives of high-ranking officers, their daughters, female relatives of the political elite, and a number of female German military personnel. The military staff were present presumably to assist the female civilians, or perhaps to guard them in the remotely possible event the Soviet forces breached the mountain's defenses. Aside from the female military personnel, Annie, her mother, and Natalia were the only people carrying weapons. She could see her mother sitting down, her pistol belt across her lap. Her mother sat a great deal these days. The baby, of course. She could see Natalia pacing back and forth, smoking a cigarette, angry looks fired at her because she was polluting the scrubbed air. Annie recalled the lines from John Milton. "Thousands at his bidding speed, and post o'er land and ocean without rest. They also serve who only stand and wait." She wasn't standing, and she was already damn tired of waiting. Darkwood looked at the dual display on the face of his Steinmetz chronometer. There was absolutely no reason in the world to want or need to know the time just now. His world was circumscribed by an open doorway in the belly of a flying machine thousands of feet over the ocean. Whatever time it was in New Germany or in Midwake or anywhere else was of absolutely no concern. He supposed he studied the face of his watch because it was a familiar face. He couldn't see the faces of Sam Aldridge, Dr. Rourke, Paul Rubenstein, or Michael Rourke. Each of them, like himself and all the others, wore helmets, effectively masked from familiar recognition. They all stood, suited up, ready to throw body and soul into the air and plummet toward the ocean's surface. This ocean was unfamiliar to him. He'd logged innumerable, or so it seemed, miles in the service of his country, but at no time did the service take him out of the world's largest ocean, the Pacific.
Water is water, salt is salt.
Poets, and scientists to a degree, spoke of the waters of the ocean and the liquid content of the human body being alike. The poets pondered its significance, philosophized over the hidden meaning, while the scientists... What did the scientists do? They drew conclusions, of course, but only tentative conclusions, because each mystery unraveled only led to another mystery still to be solved. In the 5 centuries since the fall of the old surface Earth, neither poets nor scientists solved very much. In their way, both poets and scientists were philosophers. Men and women and children still died. Wars were still fought. The sea took back its own, and if blood and seawater held so much in common, in the end, then, they became indistinguishable one from the other. In the fuselage doorway, John Rourke turned to the others.
Be ready!
Jason Darkwood studied the light over the door. The light, still red, was unfamiliar, although he knew its purpose. Aboard his vessel, the Reagan, a shift to red meant that night vision was to be preserved for likely surfacing. Here, a shift to green meant that all one's past and all one's future rested on how well packed was a piece of flimsy cloth called a parachute. There were even holes in this terrifying thing, intentionally placed there. What if the holes were in the wrong spots, or there were just too many of them? He learned, when he pushed to be released prematurely from medical treatment to join this mission, that parachuting was quite routine. He also knew that without him, assuming the first phase of the mission succeeded, neither the second nor third phase held any real hope for success. The realization was not the fantasy of ego, although ego was good and necessary, but arose from an objective evaluation of their task. The business about parachutes was roughly the same sort of thing they'd told him at the academy the first time he'd put on wings and a HEMA sponge and slipped out of an airlock. After a time, survival and day-to-day activity in the water became routine. But there were backups, things one could do underwater that one could not do, Darkwood imagined, while falling out of an aircraft. During training, he talked with Rourke about worst-case scenarios.
So, Doctor, what do I do besides die, I mean? Should my primary chute fail and my secondary chute fail?
Well, it all depends, Jason.
On what, sir?
On how resourceful you are. How able to overcome fear sufficiently to act.
But what action is appropriate?
Why don't you guess, and then I'll tell you if you're right.
That seemed fair enough, certainly, and Darkwood carefully considered his response.
What is it, Doctor?
I was just simulating the sound of your body impacting a hard surface without an open chute. A falling body accelerates at a speed of 32 feet per second. Per second, of course. And the initial height would...
I took too long?
You took too long.
Okay, well, so, assuming I bounced, how do I get my chute open?
What would you do if your equipment malfunctioned underwater?
Well, fix it, of course.
Right. The problem with a parachute isn't usually the chute itself. Either it won't open at all, or at least not properly, or when it does, it becomes tangled up. In the latter case, if there's time, cut away your primary chute if you think you'll need to. That'll give you something else to think about until you hit.
And in the former case?
Manually start the chute, but in such a way that you don't mutilate it or tangle it.
It sounds like dying is simpler.
Yeah, well, it happens more often.
Jason Darkwood touched the Smithsonian buoy now. At least he could try. The light went green.
Geronimo!
John Rourke vanished from the doorway. Michael wondered why his father, an eminently sensible man, would shout such an inane expression. Because thousands of other men shouted it as they dove out of airplanes? Michael thought of a better thing to say.
Shit.
Geronimo!
Ahead of him, Paul jumped. Michael approached the doorway, his eyes on the red light. It went green. He jumped.
Shit!
Michael felt like an idiot. Worse, he was spinning. He knew he shouldn't be spinning. Then he remembered to stop shouting into his helmet and deafening himself, and to use his arms and legs to stabilize himself. It would have been worse if it were night, because now at least he could see some of the others coming after him through the doorway. His body twisted, and then he could see nothing but the whiteness of the clouds all around him. Couldn't see his father, couldn't see Paul either. Then he was through, and suddenly he reached a crest of ground. But instead of lying below him, it stretched above him. Below him, he saw his father and his friend. They were so near that if he'd been able to maneuver halfway decently, he could have reached out and touched them, linked hands like he'd seen skydivers doing in videos at the retreat. He remembered to look at his chest pack. Plenty of altitude remained, according to the digital altimeters. There was plenty of time before he had to open a chute. He was falling, but so remarkably slowly he realized he was smiling, enjoying the sensations. How wonderful it would be to do this without every square centimeter of his body being covered. Euphoria. That was what it was. The German sergeant, with the stumbling English, however halting, vastly better than Michael's still meager German, explained it in training.
When in the air, dropping through, there is sometimes the feeling in English called euphoria, whereby the parachute dropping man is much very excited and does not his own descent control happens.
On one level of consciousness, Michael Rourke realized he was no longer thinking clearly. But God, it was so beautiful and so free, like the birds he remembered from his childhood. He felt tears rising in his eyes, for the birds, for all of them. Except for the comparative few the Germans released and those meager numbers in zoological confinement, the rest were gone forever. He saw his father, or was it Paul? Normally, the height discrepancy would have been a dead...
Dead?
Euphoria. Euphoria had been making love with Madison, his once and forever wife. And if he were dead, what he'd been taught as a child, though he sometimes questioned it, was that he would be reunited with Madison. He would see their child. Did dead people see? Would their child forever be a child? Or were all spirits one age and therefore ageless? His eyes drifted over the water. How lovely it was. Peaceful. And how beautiful were the chutes opening above him.
Above me. Above me. Above me!
He glanced at the two altimeters. He was almost... Michael triggered his primary chute, the main chute blossoming above him, jerking him up. The line surrounding him snapped stiff. He reached up as he looked down. The surface rushed away, slowed, just seemed to hang below him. He tugged at the lines as instructed to guide his descent as the water rose to meet him. Already, one of the chutes was on the water, under the water, and gone. A second chute. Michael's feet hit the water, and he seemed to fall forward into it as a wave crashed over him, and down, down he fell. He tapped at the quick release fixture for the parachute harness, but then suddenly he was suffocating. Michael rolled and thrashed as he activated the controls for the hemisponge, and his helmet systems came alive. The wings he'd never tried opened from his back as he moved through the water like a bird in the air. John was grateful for the time he spent learning the diving systems of Midwake, grateful because the experience was at once enlightening and enjoyable. He was grateful now because he felt nearly at home as his wings furled and unfurled, hovering, his wings beating gently, the air processed by his hemosponge tasting fresh enough, his body warm but pleasantly so in his black dry suit, all helmet systems operational. He switched to vision intensification. And fewer than 50 feet below the surface, the difference was so instantly pronounced that his eyes automatically squinted against the light. The sea was life. Unlike the land, all around him, John saw life in abundance. Two Atlantic blunt-nosed jacks, both large for the species, about a foot in length, swam past him, golden yellow. Their second dorsal fins quivered. He watched them and was startled when, at the far left corner of his peripheral vision, something moved snake-like toward him. He reached for the grain LS-10 as his wings fluttered to draw him back. Then Rourke smiled. The silvery creature was merely a cutlass fish. Paul moved through the water toward him, another jack giving the younger man a wide berth. From above, his wings moving erratically, Rourke saw his son, Michael. And in the next instant, the surface was as alive as if a school of sharks were feeding. Parachute packs sank toward the ocean floor as wings unfurled and black-helmeted men, Sti-20 pistols in their hands, swam down.
Let's go, men!
Rourke signaled with his hands, and the translucent-winged men of the attack force floated through the water toward him. Darkwood tipped his helmet against Rourke's.
I'm home, Doctor. The parachute ride wasn't that bad, but I'll take the water over the air any day.
You have a beautiful world. If we're successful, perhaps your people will someday be able to benefit from its full potential.
Darkwood seemed about to speak, but then Paul joined them, touched helmets with theirs.
Michael had a little difficulty, but he's fine. All our people from the J7V are accounted for.
Pass the word, then. We'll follow Darkwood.
Right.
Paul was gone. Darkwood seemed to be checking a compass, then touched helmets again.
If the German intelligence was correct and we airdropped pretty close to our target, like they say in the old Western movies, that-a-way.
Darkwood gestured into the gloom below them and north.
That-a-way.
The men of the team organized themselves into a wedge formation, standard Midwake procedure. Two of the men swam ahead as an advance guard. Darkwood's wings spread, and he seemed to glide down in an easy roll. Paul and Michael flanked him. John Rourke followed. The water around Jason vibrated. He half-furled his wings, hovering. He felt the shockwave build, strike, pass, like a gentle slap. The others would guess at what happened, but there was no time for a conference. Just behind him, Dr. Rourke, Paul Rubenstein, and Michael Rourke waited. Sam Aldridge and the rest of the force behind them in a larger wedge hovered. Darkwood unfurled his wings fully, gliding ahead through the water, using hands and flippers sparingly to conserve his strength. He was nearly recovered from his wounds. The fatigue factor was something he considered before deciding to volunteer, but again, personal circumstances could not be helped. He was needed to do what had to be done. Jason touched his chest pack, shifting from vision intensification to magnification, always the wise choice first, lest one inadvertently focus in on something so bright that the intensified light was momentarily blinding. Though there were shapes ahead, there was no bright light source. He added vision intensification to magnification. He saw the hull of a Soviet island-class submarine ahead, one of the more than three dozen missile-launching ports closed as another two opened. Dr. Rourke, Michael, and Paul were close enough. Darkwood touched helmets with the other three.
Tell everyone to make certain vision intensification is off. We have a launch imminent just ahead. I'll warn the advance guard. After the launch, join me.
Right.
Immediately, Jason switched off magnification, altered the beating of his wings to start a roll, and used both hands and flippers as rapidly as he could. His vision intensification was still on. If not, he would be uncertain of finding the two advance guards, at least one of them likely a German commando unused to the more subtle nuances of his equipment. Darkwood skirted around a towering rock formation and through a school of cod. The creatures scattered about him. Just ahead, he saw two figures. He changed direction to intercept them, touching his chest pack to disengage vision intensification. The launch concussion hammered him this time, a column of white vapor and churning water. The missile broke the surface as Darkwood was thrown back into the rocks. His helmet slammed into an outcropping of coral. Automatically, he had furled his wings. If not, they would have been destroyed. His ears rang, his senses reverberated with the sounds from the launch. He braced himself, knowing the second missile would launch, and launch it did. Darkwood huddled in the rocks and coral. Creatures rose from the deep in their frantic rush to escape the source of their terror. The ringing in Darkwood's ears persisted, but the concussion subsided. He pushed away from the rocks, dodging back as a large shark grazed past him. Jason unfurled his wings, swimming toward the last position where he saw the two advance guards. He risked vision intensification again, scanning right to left. Jason saw one of the men, wings shredded, body twisted at an unnatural angle. He swam to the man. A quick examination confirmed what logic already suggested. As quickly as he could now, before another launch, he began quartering to search for the second man. Annie grabbed Maria into her arms. They dropped to their knees. Annie just held her as the mountain around them trembled and the platform on which they were sheltered gently swayed. Annie pulled the shawl around her shoulders over her head and Maria's as dust and grit sprinkled down on them from the cavern ceiling above. They were under attack. Was it nuclear?
They'd be dead now if it was.
Her husband, her brother, her father. Did they not reach the Soviet submarines in time? Or no pain cut through her. She knew if any of the three of them died, she would feel death as if she too were struck down.
Michael's fine, Maria. Take it easy.
Annie reassured the woman, trembling beside her.
We'll be safe here, too.
Safe, while above them the city itself might be in ruins. Soon Soviet surface forces would attack. Annie looked along the platform, her mother crouched beneath a table, on hands and knees. Natalia stood almost defiantly, the hood of her jacket raised, protecting her hair from the falling dust and debris. Annie hugged Maria closer.
I wish there was something that we could do, but we cannot. It is terrible to be a woman.
Annie held her tongue. Her father taught her many years ago, and Paul's very existence confirmed that life was indeed what you made it. Her eyes caught the eyes of her mother. They merely looked at one another across the dozens of women who sat or knelt about the platform, letting their fate rest in hands other than their own. Her mother smiled and nodded almost imperceptibly. Annie held Maria tighter because she wouldn't be holding her for long. A body spiraled down along the north wall of a narrow canyon about 1,000 yards from the portside hull of the nearest island classer. If the man were still alive, one of the Germans, he would surely die if he did not regain consciousness and slow or stop his descent. As Darkwood hovered over the abyss, he felt a tap at the side of his helmet. It was Dr. Rourke. Their helmets touched.
You've lost a man down there. Could he still be alive?
We lost a Marine in the last detonation. That's a German in the canyon. If he's alive, he won't be much longer. Keep the men sheltered while I go after him. After the next launch, approach the submarine going for the stern. If I'm not back...
No, you're the only one who could pull off this mission. I'll go after him. You lead the men toward the submarine and I'll catch up. As a doctor, maybe I could do something for the man to save his life. Now go on.
There wasn't time to argue because each second took the hapless German to greater depth and brought the next missile firing that much closer.
All right, Doctor. Good luck.
Rourke nodded almost imperceptibly, cocooning his wings around him as if he'd been diving with this equipment all his life, launching himself over the side of the canyon and into the abyss. Darkwood watched after him for a split second more. He accelerated the beating of his wings and made for the rest of the attack force. Using his flippers, arms locked against his sides, hands flat against his thighs except when he moved them slightly as stabilizers, Rourke spiraled down, keeping the pace of his descent within reason, but moving as fast as he could while still giving his suit the time to equalize pressure. Below him, he could no longer see the man. Rourke touched his chest pack, starting vision intensification. He was well enough below the level of the nearest Soviet vessel that he felt he could risk it. Still no sign of the injured or unconscious, probably both, German commando. Rourke activated magnification. He followed the heads-up navigational display in his helmet faceplate to keep his orientation. In the center of the faceplate, where magnification had its effect, he saw an odd shape against a rock formation another 60 or 70 feet below him, hard to see despite magnification and vision intensification. Rourke slowed his descent. He cocooned his wings and clung to the rocky walls of the canyon, careful where he put his hands despite the strength of his gloves. In these waters, there could be anything. A type of sea snake once lived in the Pacific, perhaps still did, whose bite always proved fatal. Its venom acted so quickly on the central nervous system that the victim expired in seconds before any sort of medical procedure could begin. John moved diagonally down the rock face. He reasoned the next missile or missiles would launch soon, and he had no idea what the shockwave might do in the confined space between the canyon walls. So he clung to the wall. The force of at least two shockwaves rolled over him. Rourke slammed into the canyon wall. He barely hung on to the rock outcroppings. Below him, the shape moved. Rourke knew it was the man he sought. The man lay on the edge of an abyss deeper than the canyon, a bottomless trench, running along the seafloor like a scar, to the north and south. Fish swarmed about Rourke, over him, around him, as he held to his purchase against the canyon wall, large pieces of the very wall itself dislodged above and around him, rolling down into the already churning waters surrounding him. More rocks dislodged, creating a full-scale avalanche. Rourke pushed off the canyon wall, no other choice now for his survival. He let his wings partly out, then, churning through the current with his hands and his feet, John Rourke raced the avalanche to the helpless man. Darkwood led the commandos forward, his eyes on the missile deck of the nearest submarine. If a missile launched now, the shockwave would kill them. And where was John? Was he caught in the maelstrom of the multiple launches that took place seconds ago? If so, was he dead? Jason couldn't imagine that after all this time, the incredible perils Rourke endured for more than five centuries, that the man might be lost in an undersea tempest. New hatches opened on the missile deck of the nearest of the island classers. Any of the other ones, there were at least two more, might launch at any second as well. Exposed as they were, moving toward the vessel's stern, they would die. Once beneath her hull, however, they could take shelter. Fatigue was beginning to take its toll on Darkwood.
What was I thinking? I haven't recovered enough to be out here. Ah, come on, Jason. Who else can do this? Stop thinking and swim.
Jason kept swimming, no longer able to conserve physical energy and let wings alone propel him through the water. He glanced at the Steinmetz on his wrist and risked vision intensification to read it. There should be another launch in seconds. Darkwood made a command decision. He signaled the wedge of divers to either side of him to veer off to the underside of the island classer's hull. They'd lose precious time in reaching the hoped-for penetration point, but there was no choice if they were to survive. Darkwood swam for the underside of the island-class submarine's hull. Annie clutched her chest. Her entire body went limp. She fell forward.
Oh no! Annie! Help!
Annie saw, Annie felt, infinite black. A wave of nausea passed over her, dizziness so intense that her consciousness began to ebb.
Oh! Natalia! Mama! Natalia!
Annie sprawled onto the floor of the platform, clutching at her throat, trying to hold back the blackness closing in around her.
Annie?
Da!
Your father?
Da! Natalia!
Walls of blackness closed around her, and she was spinning. The dark spun into a swirl faster and faster. Her arms were no longer numb, but ached from holding her body. But the body she held was not her own, and her mind searched for something.
Anne? What is it?
Mom!
Open the collar of her blouse, Natalia. She's having some sort of attack. I don't know.
There, Annie. Try to breathe.
We need a doctor. We need a doctor over here.
The darkness deepened, welled up within her mind, blotting out thought. Her arms hurt so badly. She wanted to reach out to something and stop. Above her, she saw her mother's face, Natalia's face. She heard Maria screaming for help. Hands touched her. She couldn't let go of the body she held so tight. The darkness consumed her. John's arms ached. He was aware of the body he held more than he had been an instant earlier. Why? This guy was going to die too? Was that it? The heel of Rourke's right hand rested against something hard. What was it? Only a very small portion of John's mind still functioned, like a tiny flickering flame surrounded by snuffing blackness, nearly out. What could this object be? He searched and searched, and wondered if perhaps the information he sought were not within the boundaries of that ever-shrinking light. At last, he found what he sought. The object was an explosive charge for use against the screw of an island classer, in the event the vessel could not be penetrated, but had to be crippled instead. Several members of each team from the J7Vs carried these charges with them for use against the main screws and other vulnerable areas of the monstrous machines. Rourke felt a momentary glow of pride. He remembered. The tiny flame grew dim. John knew he had to push back the blackness surrounding it. Yes, if he could do that, he could retrieve the other thing nagging his mind. What was that? Something about an explosive charge and the nature of a current? He spun uncontrollably as he fought back the dark. He tried to remember what it was that he was supposed to remember. Several missiles fired as if in battery. Jason Darkwood felt it was at least marginally safe to proceed. He signaled Michael Rourke and Paul Rubenstein aft, with half the remaining men along the port side of the submarine's underbelly. Sam Aldridge and the balance of the men accompanied Darkwood to starboard. Darkwood focused on the dual display of his Steinmetz. In 3 minutes, they would attempt to breach the vessel. German intelligence overflights hinted strongly at three Soviet vessels positioned offshore. Going on that assumption, Dr. Rourke had elected targets for each of the teams airdropped from the J7Vs, designating the island-class vessels simply as numbers 1 through 3. Number 1 cruised farthest south, number 3 farthest north. And each team got a pre-designated rendezvous time and location. 2 minutes and 43 seconds remained before Darkwood's team and two others began their assault on island-class number 1. They were to rendezvous beneath the main diver access hatch. Where was John Rourke? Darkwood, a Soviet Stai 20 pneumatic in his right fist, his helmet on vision intensification, swam ahead. They needed surprise to succeed. If a single flipper tip touched prematurely against the submarine's hull, if a random video scan caught them and the operator were observant or the scan were computer-linked, they would be undone. Fish might graze against the sides of a submarine hovering in the water in neutral buoyancy. Each touch meant an automatic video scan of the hull. Hulls of island-class vessels, like something out of Jules Verne, could be electrified. Any living creature touching the hull would meet instant death. If security detected intruding forces, Soviet Navy defense options included release of Claymore clusters, cluster-like charges similar to those used defensively in the United States Navy by attack submarines like the Reagan that Darkwood captained. But unlike standard cluster charges of high explosive, the Soviet anti-personnel cluster charges were similar to the Claymore mines of the Vietnam War more than 5 centuries ago. When Claymore clusters triggered, a comparatively small explosive charge propelled thousands of nearly microscopic fiberglass darts in all directions. The darts were not strong enough to penetrate or even stick to the hull of their submarine, but were amply strong to penetrate the suit of a diver. Darkwood twice saw victims of Claymore clusters. Very little recognizable as human remained of them. John Rourke's flame flickered feebly, near death. Thoughts of his wife and daughter, his son, Paul and Natalia, the only people in his adult life he ever loved, seemed much more important to him now than trying to recall what it was he could do with the explosive charge the German commando carried on his utility belt. If somehow he stopped the flow of the current, how could he ever find his way back to the rest of the attack force? Time was gone now. Minutes or hours or anything between might have passed since he fell victim to the current. Rourke smiled. Stopping the flow of the current would be as likely as stopping the flow of time. His arms grew so weary of holding the German. Still, he clung to his fading glimmer of life. Soon enough, darkness would quench it. Sarah Rourke held her daughter's head against her breast. The sedative injection was taking hold.
He's dying. Dying. Daddy Jesus.
Sarah touched her lips to Annie's hair. She caressed her daughter's face. Annie was experiencing her father's death.
Oh, Lord.
He's more than mortal. How can he die?
Sarah put her left arm around Natalia and drew her head to her shoulder.
One little glimmer.
Annie's gift of the mind was the most horrible of curses. Annie was, mentally, experiencing her father's death as surely as if somehow she were inside him, as if she were her father. Sarah Rourke wondered, when the actual moment came, would Annie die too? Sarah kissed Natalia's forehead.
We're in this together, all of us, and nothing will change that.
Natalia started to pull away. Sarah held her.
You don't have to be strong now.
Natalia's arms went around Sarah and held her tight.
Stopping the flow. Stopping flow.
Sarah held her daughter and her rival, held them as tight as she could. Tears filled her eyes. The platform shook. Another missile strike. Dust and grit streamed down from the cavern ceiling. Perhaps Annie's curse was a blessing in disguise. If the missiles successfully destroyed the mountain and the cavern ceiling collapsed, Annie might be so consumed by her father's death that she would be spared the experience of her own. Sarah bit her lower lip, holding on to these two women, both of them closer to her than any sisters could be. She looked away for a moment and saw Maria Loydon, hands cupped in front of her, looking like some woebegone little girl who had done some terrible thing and now expected to be punished.
Maria, come kneel beside me.
Maria hesitantly came forward and dropped to her knees. Sarah reached out to Maria, taking the young woman's hand, and held it tight.
The flower.
Rourke's flame flickered its last, but as it did, the dark flow stopped.
The flow.
Use the explosive charge. John fought the darkness.
The flow.
If he could stop the flow of time. No, time wasn't what he needed to stop. The current. If he could stop the flow of the current. The glimmer began to grow, pushing back the dark. At the edge of the flame, there must be a portion of reason, resourcefulness, remaining. It pushed back the dark, but it wouldn't last long. The explosive charge, use the explosive charge, stop the flow. The walls of the abyss shot past. No, that wasn't right. They were massive sheets of rock, stationary. He was moving past them, spiraling around and around and around. The dark closed in again. He fought it back. Use the charge. Activate the timer. Set the charge. Stop the flow. Rourke flexed the fingers of his right hand, moved them down the German commando's ribcage to the explosive charge attached to the man's utility belt. Jason Darkwood touched helmets with his team commanders. They hovered beneath the primary hatch.
I should do it. You're beat already, Jace.
Captain Jace Sam, huh? No. You guys wait. I'll lock the missile hatch.
And what if you don't swim fast enough, Captain? You're dead then, and you're the only one of us qualified to take command of this friggin' submarine once we're inside.
I swim fast enough, Sam.
Darkwood holstered the Sty 20, then took the bar taped alongside Sam Aldridge's right thigh. Sam was right, of course, but as they swam their way aft, Darkwood came to the realization that John Rourke was likely dead and wouldn't have been if Jason hadn't let the doctor talk him out of the dangerous thing just so Jason could get inside the Soviet submarine. He wouldn't cost another man his life this day if he could help it. Sam held the bar.
Let it go, Sam. That's an order.
His lifelong friend let go of the bar.
You get killed, I'm pissed, Jace.
Well, we wouldn't want you ticked off, would we, Sam?
Aldridge pulled back from the huddle, let his wings flex, and rolled, then started swimming up along the submarine's starboard side hull and toward the missile deck. Rourke punched the charge into a crack in the wall of rock. Part of the outer layer of his glove ripped away, he guessed. How many seconds? Together, both arms wrapped around the body of the man, they spun down, deeper and deeper. And the roar grew and grew. Rourke's body and the body of the German slammed against the wall of the abyss. They stopped. Nausea swept over him. Rourke held the German in his left arm and reached out with his right, praying his wings still worked. He flung himself and the German commando away from the wall and into the black water beyond. Tons of rock crashed around them. Loose dirt and debris dislodged by the avalanche formed a cloud around them. A current eddied across the void. Rourke twisted his body to escape it, dragging the German with him. The water churned around them. Rourke held the German commando to him. The last of the rocks tumbled away into the deeper reaches of the abyss. Rourke hovered there in the water with the German still in his arms. There was nothing but silence and darkness. Annie fell quiet. Sarah assumed the sedative had taken full effect. Maria Loydon held Annie's hand as she knelt beside her. The bombardment continued. Natalia's hair and the shoulders of her black jumpsuit showed streaks of gray dust. Natalia, drained of emotion, knelt back on her heels.
If he dies, even if we win, I cannot help but feel all of this was for nothing.
No. Don't say that. Look at you.
I am covered with dust. I'm trapped where my only real skills are valueless. Look at me indeed.
No. Look at who you were and who you are. What you've survived and triumphed over. You even went through a nervous breakdown and survived that. Triumphed. You're a better person today than you ever were.
Isn't it odd? You and I being friends.
Sarah looked down at her abdomen, smiling.
Yes. We both love the same man. I guess that gives us a lot in common. And I'm glad you're my friend. And despite things, I think we always would have remained friends.
I'll stay with you and the others until your baby comes, if you like. You're pretty good at protecting yourself, but for a while, you might need a protector.
A friend. And I'll need a friend always.
Look!
Sarah turned to Maria, who was staring at Annie. There was a look of peacefulness on the face of her daughter.
Do you think...
Yes? Maybe. He's hard to kill, the man we love.
Jason Darkwood hovered by the rail of the island-class missile deck, vision intensification off, but the missile hatches close enough he could see them clearly. The filtered sunlight overhead and the face of his wristwatch agreed, mid-morning now, nearly as bright as it would get at their depth. Midwake Naval Intelligence knew very little about the island-class submarine's missile launch procedures, but Sebastian, first officer of the Reagan, was one of the two smartest men Jason Darkwood knew. John Rourke, likely dead now, was the other. Sebastian calculated a computer program on the launch sequence system of the Soviet island-class missiles. Darkwood surveyed the missile deck now. Given the contrail blackened hatch areas, Sebastian's program seemed to be holding.
It is relatively simple, Jason, to a point. Admiral Severinsky's chief of staff, as we well know, is a devotee of chess and piano, both devotions much to his credit, may I add. In chess, of course, there are 32 pieces, 16 major and 16 pawns.
Yes, Sebastian, 32 pieces, so what?
There are 40 missile tubes, Jason.
Sebastian cocked his eyebrows, Darkwood getting the distinct impression that his tall, lean, muscular, and extraordinarily intelligent first officer expected him, Jason Darkwood, to draw some marvelous conclusion from the relationship between the numbers 32 and 40. Darkwood took a stab at it.
Okay, so the missile deck incorporates 1/5 more tubes than the number of men on the chessboard.
Actually, the chessboard incorporates 4/5 of the number of missile tubes, Jason. But indeed, fifths are the key.
Fifths? You mean like fifths of whiskey?
Further. Yes. Well, the Soviet fleet grade officers have been known to imbibe a bit, I suppose, although vodka is their usual preference. But I refer, of course, to the interval of 5 diatonic degrees, or the tones of the standard major and minor scale to the exclusion of the chromatics. So, if the 40 missile tubes were viewed as 40 keys on the piano, where of course there would normally be 88, then we proceed from the point of origin by whole steps. Therefore, whichever missile tube was fired first would serve as the starting note, but would of necessity be a whole step further, assuming the progression begins to approximate middle C, which would most closely approximate the number of tubes as opposed to the number of keys remaining on the piano, then the missiles would fire in sequence of the 6th, the 13th, the 18th, and so on. Now, once that progression is exhausted, I confess to being totally befuddled. The program within the computer of the Roy Rogers is so deeply encoded as to be currently indecipherable. So, dependent on whether the reference point were fore or aft, the sequence would involve firing the 6th, then the 13th, then the 18th tube, moving on to the 25th, and then the 30th, etc. Once the firing possibilities are exhausted, unless the program were devised by someone who wished his logic to be almost diabolically obtuse, one might readily assume that the progression would start again, run until the battery were fully exhausted. But this latter is, I'm afraid, mere supposition, Jason.
Oh.
Jason Darkwood eyed what should, following Sebastian's mathematical progression, be the next tube fired. If it fired as he approached, he was dead. If, after he accomplished his bit of sabotage, the tube fired, they'd all be dead, because the submarine itself would explode.
Fraught with peril.
Darkwood swam forward, with the rod in his right fist. He crossed over the missile deck, careful lest a flipper inadvertently touch against its surface. He scanned the next tube Sebastian's reasoning suggested would fire. There was no movement of the hatch, nothing but Sebastian second-guessing the Soviet computer programmer to make Darkwood select this hatch. At last, he hovered over it. Carefully, he let himself down over the hatch, hoping the hatch lid was not sensitized, hoping, too, that video observation would not detect his presence. He bent over the hatch and inserted the rod between the double hinges, effectively, he hoped, locking the hatch in the closed position. As he moved away from the rod, the hatch moved, started up. Darkwood swam away, using wings, flippers, and hands. As he glanced back, the tube hatch reached a height of approximately 2 inches off level from the deck. It stuck. Jason quickened his pace. The first reaction of the launch crew would be to get a visual fix on the nature of the problem. With any luck at all, once the crew realized the hatch was jammed, a Frogman team would be dispatched to manually open it. The team would come through the main diver lock, near which his attack force waited, with any luck. John Rourke pushed the body of the German commando into a niche in the wall of the abyss. He finally had time to check the man to see if he was alive or dead. Free from the overwhelming current that drove them down, John realized there was no time for any other consideration but to escape the current before it could reclaim them. He judged they rose for more than 100 feet before finding the little cave. Inside, Rourke first examined the German to determine whether or not the man lived. Indeed, he did. Exhaustion and relief tempted John to lean back against the cave wall and rest, but because the German was alive now didn't mean the man would survive. Carefully, Rourke began the difficult task of examining the unconscious but regularly breathing German commando through the dry suit. He found evidence to suggest the man had suffered several cracked ribs, but none of them seemed broken. As best Rourke could tell under the circumstances, neither lung seemed punctured. The important thing was to get the man to the surface, where proper medical treatment could be administered. To the surface or into a submarine. John worked the chest pack, punching up coordinates, trying to determine his position in relationship to the Soviet submarines above. As best he could tell, he was a mile away from the original Island-class vessel and another 100 feet below it. How far he and the German traveled while stuck in the current was impossible to determine. John's heads-up readout indicated more than 7 miles traversed. It seemed impossible to consider the current wound so intricately within the abyss. In any event, Rourke decided, the best option was to go straight up, reassess his position, then try to rejoin Darkwood and the rest of the attack force. By now, they might well have penetrated the Soviet vessel. But if they had, why were missiles still firing? Like distant claps of spring thunder, John heard them. He checked his and the German suits. Then eased the man into his arms like an adult would carry a child. Using wings and flippers alone, Rourke launched them from the lip of the cave mouth and up into open water. Darkwood's team sheltered in the coral and rocks about 50 yards off the Soviet vessel's main diver lock, just aft of its towering sail. The other two submarines fired missiles, unleashing another storm of violent currents. Rock particles and silt washed toward them in a fast-moving wave. The Allied force hunkered down, and as the wave of debris passed, the hatch opened for the Soviet repair team. A broad shaft of yellow light knifed through the murky water, and the hatch came fully open. The Soviet divers exited in order to repair the hatch over the missile tube. Security, with the rifle versions of the Stai 20 shark guns, guarded the hatchway. Jason Darkwood and his force of commandos watched. At least the bombardment of the German mountain city was temporarily ended. How much devastation the missile strikes wrought was anyone's guess. Clearly, even given his limited experience in surface warfare, the missile attack was merely the softening up prior to a full-scale assault. Intelligence data indicated thousands of Soviet personnel in the field, their armor superior, their air power virtually a match for the German air power. The only significant German advantage was that the Germans fought from a strongly defended home base with easily accessed lines of supply. Neutralize that advantage, and the Soviets stood an excellent chance at victory. Darkwood's only possibility to reverse that potential for disaster was a hatch opening about 6 feet wide, some 50 yards away. He watched and waited. At the height of the abyss, John Rourke lay down the German commando and once again worked with the elements of his chest pack to reassess his position based on the heads-up display in his helmet visor. The display indicated one of the island-class vessels a mile or a little better from his position. Again, John took up his injured comrade. Annie rested comfortably.
Annie looks so peaceful. John must be alive.
After brushing the dust out of her hair, Natalia took one of the black silk bandanas from her purse. She tied it over her head, knotting it under her hair at the nape of the neck.
Babushka.
Annie would be a valuable ally in Natalia's plan, but she would be sedated for another several hours. The bombardment had stopped. That meant one of three possible scenarios. Either John's commando force succeeded, the city had fallen, or the Soviets suspended the bombardment to allow elements of their land force to attack. In either of the last two scenarios, being trapped in this underground vault meant certain death or capture. But outside of it, there were possibilities. One determined person could make a difference with the necessary skills to back up that determination. They could find other people and offer aid to the resistance. In any event, Natalia was useless here. She walked past Sarah and Maria, the former mouthing a silent, "Good luck," and the latter smiling. Annie rested between them on an inflatable mattress. Some of the other women in safe storage here looked at her oddly as she moved past them. Some whispered, some smiled, some cast looks of disapproval. Many women considered it unfeminine to go about in sturdy high boots, black battle dress, and heavily armed. But Natalia Anastasia Tyomarovna never considered doing the right thing unfeminine. Let them watch her, let them remark that she was being a fool or forgetting her place, whatever that was, or anything they liked. Natalia approached two of the female German officers standing off some distance from the female enlisted guards at the vault door sealing the bunker. As she approached the two lieutenants, they came to attention.
Fräulein Major!
Lieutenant, I wish to leave the leader bunker and go to aid in the fighting in the city above us.
But, Fräulein Major, it is impossible to...
Natalia shrugged her shoulders, her right palm opened, revealing the balisong, the tip of the Weehawk blade at the woman's throat.
Have the door opened now, and I wish an assault rifle and 12 loaded magazines. After I have passed through, you will secure the entry, allowing no one to pass in or out except as relates to your existing orders. Any attempt to stop me, and you...
Natalia looked at the woman straight in her startled cornflower blue eyes.
Die. If you know my reputation, then you know I do not indulge in idle threats, Lieutenant.
But...
Natalia let the point of the balisong touch the skin of the woman's throat. Not enough to puncture, but just enough to be felt.
Yes, Fräulein Major.
The Soviet swimmers were returning to the airlock hatch. With hand and arm movements, Jason Darkwood signaled the others to be ready. Michael Rourke, Paul Rubinstein, and Sam Aldridge crouched beside him. Darkwood tapped Sam Aldridge and Michael Rourke on the shoulder, and at the far right edge of his peripheral vision, he saw young Rourke pass the signal on to Paul Rubinstein. Then the four of them were moving, fanning out from cover, swimming as fast as they could toward the airlock. Most of the Soviet divers, except for the security personnel, were back inside. In his right hand, Darkwood held the identical duplicate of the Randall Smithsonian buoy. Jason glanced at Aldridge first, then at young Rourke, then at Rubinstein. Aldridge carried his copy of the K-Bar United States Marine Corps knife. Rourke, the Crane Life Support System 1, made for him at Lidveldet Island by a sword maker known as Old Jan, after the design of the Crane knife from 5 centuries ago. Rubinstein's knife was the only genuine antique, a 5-century-old spear-pointed Gerber MK2 fighting knife, a design conceived during the Vietnam War. They moved on the shark gun-armed security team. There were 7 of them, and the two nearest, Darkwood, Rourke, Rubinstein, and Aldridge, turned suddenly, as if somehow they heard something. As one of the Soviet security team personnel raised his shotgun to fire, Paul slammed against him. Paul's knife powered forward into the Soviet Marine Spetsnaz's throat. The water around them clouded dark with blood. Darkwood was on the second diver. A cloud of crimson bloomed in the yellow light as he removed his knife from the man's chest. Jason turned back to the hatch and saw a tall figure, sea wings cocooned around his shoulders, a gleaming knife with an impossibly long blade in his right hand. A cloud of blood from another dead Marine Spetsnaz floated around the knife's blade. It was John Rourke. Rourke and Darkwood's team stood amidst the dead members of the Spetsnaz diving team splayed on the deck of the submarine's diving chamber.
You all right, Doctor? I thought
I was too, Jason. Come on!
More of the midwake personnel were coming up through the hatchway, Paul and Michael leading them.
Michael! Airlock! Right.
Michael moved to the controls for the outer lock. Two of the other men helped him close it manually, while others brought through the unconscious German, whose life Rourke saved. The lock sealed.
They'll kill pressure in here. Hurry!
Hatch secure!
Be ready to give them something they don't expect once that interior hatch is blown. Look sharp!
Rourke looked to the hatch above. Darkwood assisted Michael in setting the detonator while others erected the blast shield.
Let's get that done!
Almost ready!
Paul was beside him, John aiding in assembling the roof panels. The end result looked like an igloo without a doorway, domed to deflect both shockwave and debris, constructed of a petroleum-based metallized plastic material, both fireproof and bulletproof. The entire structure assembled in under a minute in experienced hands and weighed less than 9 pounds.
Timer on! Shelters up!
The team scrambled under the shelters.
Shelters down!
The men dropped to their knees, lowering the shelters over them.
Brace!
Rourke turned his back to the shelter wall. The heels of his palms went down over the interior lip of the shelter, with Michael beside him doing the same. Across from him, Rourke could see Paul, Darkwood, and Aldridge under the translucent dome.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1!
Rourke ducked his head involuntarily as the fireball rolled over the dome.
Gas grenades!
The commandos pulled their masks over their heads and shouldered the shelters onto their sides as Aldridge, a German officer, and Han Lu Chen raced to the opening beneath the porthole. The three braced stubby-barreled launchers about the size of shotguns against their thighs and fired 8-inch-long gas grenades up through the well of the airlock and through what used to be a hatch. The gas was odorless and tasteless, but turned deep rose color in the air. Its knockout agent would put anyone who breathed it to sleep for better than 2 hours, according to the German scientists. Gas billowed down, purplish wisps of it in layers near the overhead.
Stun grenades!
Michael and Paul moved forward, hand-lobbing sound and light grenades up through the hatch opening. Rourke rammed both scoremasters into his utility belt.
Watch it!
Rourke averted his eyes, cupping both hands over his face. Even with his eyes squinted shut, Rourke saw a flash for a split second. Michael and Paul moved under the hatchway, John behind them. Michael and Paul dropped to their knees. Rourke climbed onto their backs, reached up, grabbed for a handhold, and carefully pulled up and through the ragged outline where the hatch blew from its flange. Rourke rolled onto the deck. There was no resistance here. He racked the slide of one of the scoremasters up the safety, put the gun into his belt, then racked the second pistol. He drew the first gun again. Now Paul, then Michael, then Darkwood, then Aldridge rose out of the hatchway. Purple smoke hung heavy everywhere around them, both fore and aft in the ready room. A watertight doorway was shut just beyond.
Demolition! Fix that!
Bring that injured German up here and assign a man to stay with him.
Yes, sir!
Rourke hustled to the doorway, Paul and Michael flanking him.
Let's have more gas ready and more sound and light!
Time was the commodity most precious to them now, Rourke realized. If the Soviets had the chance to electronically seal each watertight doorway, fighting to seize the submarine would be compartment by compartment, and still the Soviet commander would be able to continue launching the rest of his missile complement against New Germany. The Marine by the hatch gave a hand signal.
Stand back!
The center of the watertight doorway blew outward. Aldridge and Han Lu Chen ran up, firing gas grenades through the opening. Aldridge and Han stepped away. Michael and Paul lobbed sound and light grenades through the opening.
Watch it!
A German commando ran to the doorway as the sound died, stabbed the muzzle of his assault rifle through the opening, firing the weapon right and left and up and down. A Marine from Midway worked the lock mechanism, and three men raced through the opening as soon as the door swung back. John followed, stepping over the flange and into the corridor beyond.
More gas! Lots of it!
Two of the commandos, along with Han and Aldridge, began firing gas grenades in both directions along the corridor. Darkwood pointed forward.
Follow me!
John, Paul, and Michael sprinted after Jason. The corridor was interrupted at another watertight door, but this one was only closed, not locked.
Just routine during combat. So far, so good.
Han and the three commandos fired their gas rounds into the companionway beyond. John and Michael raced through the hatch, taking up flanking positions on the opposite side of the doorway as Sam and a half dozen other men passed through. Darkwood, his issue midweight Lancer 9mm in hand, stepped over the flange.
The reactor room, gentlemen! Let's move!
Darkwood jogged along the corridor in the wake of a wedge of Marines led by Sam Aldridge. Rourke walked quietly after them, his son and his friend on either side of him. His knowledge of Island-class submarines was limited, but assuming their layout followed a pattern similar to that outlined in Darkwood's briefing, the logical place for an ambush would be between the reactor complex and the crew's quarters. Access to the command deck could be restricted merely by closing a hatch access, and the commander of the Island-class submarine would assume, perhaps rightly, that an explosion could not be risked, lest navigational and other instrumentation be damaged or destroyed. Fighting into the crew's quarters or officers' quarters farther forward could be sealed off or at least stalled by personnel in the crew's and officers' mess above. The only danger would be that invaders would sabotage the reactor room, but the results of such an action could threaten every life aboard, officers, crew, and attackers. John caught up with Darkwood.
Paul and Michael and I are taking a different route. That way, if you get boxed in, we may be able to attack from the rear.
Darkwood looked at Rourke for an instant, then nodded his head.
Okay, good idea, Doctor, but be careful. See ya.
Rourke, Paul, and Michael peeled off into a side companionway.
What's up, John?
They passed through the clouds of purple gas as it slowly diffused.
Darkwood and his people won't be getting slowed down by intruder defense systems because they're all gas-related and we're masked and the surface suits protect us from skin absorption. But there should be armed resistance once they've passed into or through the reactor room.
We can lead the machinery spaces and reach the science labs if I remember Darkwood's briefing well enough.
John looked at Michael. Michael nodded.
Yeah, there's an access tube. Then what?
From the science, it's an easy shot to medical. And then just forward of that is the car.
But from the back door. Let's do it.